Well, hello and welcome once again to FAA Safety Briefing Live. This is the July and August review of the magazine. And I'm here with Susan Parson. Susan, how are you this evening?
I'm good, especially since it's raining here in Arizona right now. It's really exciting to rain in the desert.
What's that like when it's raining in the desert?
Wet. Actually, it looks like we have a nice little thunderstorm coming over. I heard some thunder a few minutes ago, and I can hear the rain outside on the windows. So as I've said before, when I first came to Arizona, I was a little amused at how excited people got about water, but I get it. I understand that now. So absolutely, it's an exciting night to be in Arizona.
Well, and it addresses the topic that we're going to discuss to some extent today, and that is about the environment and how we're coping with various elements and the changes. Before we get started, though, we've made some changes to how you can access the WINGS program. And can you tell us about that, please?
Well, basically, it's a lot easier than it used to be. The FAA safety team folks who run the webpage understood that people were a little frustrated with the number of steps that it took to get to the quiz sometimes. So it's now a two-step process, and it's much easier to take this course, which this counts as a course, and then click the link to the WINGS credit and get right to the quiz, take the quiz, and get your WINGS credit.
We often talk about this. What are the goals of the magazine? And let's go ahead and do a review, and then maybe talk a little bit more about the history of it.
Well, this is the 60th year. I'm going to have to change the slide in a couple of issues from now, but we wanted to promote our 60th year. We've had a variety of different names and designs over the years, but you see here, what are the goals? The safety policy voice for non-commercial GA, and the goals are pretty simple: raise awareness of resources, explain safety and regulatory issues from the perspective of the regulatory agency, and something that we care both of us very much about, which is encourage continued training. And over on the far right, you see that we have a purpose and a particular mission statement, if you will, for each of the regular departments in the magazine, and we try to stick to that. As far as how it's put together, we publish every couple of months, but we're already wrapping up work on the next issue, because we have to work, given the clearances and the publication timeframes and everything else that we have to go through. We work quite a bit ahead, I think, as many publications do. So we always have plenty to do.
Well, and you do it well. The content is always good, and the design has certainly changed, you know, over the years, and it's an attractive publication. And I don't know if you've been counting, but I certainly have. This is our 20th broadcast of FAA Safety Briefing Live. When I was looking through all the magazine covers that come through in the introduction, it certainly reminded me of some of our reviews and some of the topics. And I had some favorite issues in there, and some that I spent more time learning about, which is the purpose of all of this, of course. So happy anniversary.
Thank you. And to I didn't realize, because I didn't count.
guys do that. So
yeah, I know. Actually, it's usually the other way around, but we'll leave it at that.
I learned that a long time ago. So the cover is very interesting. It's all about embracing the environment. And what are some of the things we can look forward to?
Well, there's the list of features is there, the shocking potential, electric aviation, which is a big thing. We'll look at some of the initiatives with avgas, noise, wildlife, light bulbs. And in this issue, we also get to recognize the GA award winners. But I want to talk about, this has got to be one of my favorite covers. We gave our designer some basic concepts, and, you know, we wanted to use this and that. And she came back with this lovely take on the recycling symbol using trees and airplanes and green. And by the way, I decided to wear green tonight in honor of this issue. So it's all about, you know, keeping with the theme. But I think this is going to be one of my favorite all-time covers.
Well, it is. And the issue and the content that we're covering, it's certainly appropriate for today's world and appropriate for going forward in the future. So I'm looking forward to reviewing some of this with you. And let's have a look at the first column, which is the Jump Seat article by Rick Domingo. And it starts out with a bit of a play on words, and that is a climate for change. So what's the focus? What will we look forward to?
Well, this column is always the executive policy perspective, but it's also about setting up and introducing the issue, why we decided to do this. And I think, no matter where you live is what it says. And these days in flight standards, even before the pandemic, we were dispersed and we're using, I like the term distributed workforce, which I think is very accurate. But the fact of the matter is that we have somebody in flight standards who is affected by pretty severe weather and climate conditions pretty much all the time. Sure. Last summer, well, and right now there are wildfires in a lot of places. There was the freezing weather in Texas. There are floods. There's all sorts of things. And so we thought that it was an appropriate time to look at and think about those things. Also, because there's so much excitement about all of the new technology, electric aircraft in particular, but we have some of the same issues like avgas, lead, which is leaded fuel, noise concerns, and then we definitely wanted to do a little bit of a review of some of the wildlife issues. So,
well, and as I was getting ready for this, might have been a couple of days ago, I came across an article in one of the newspapers. And it introduced a concept that I was not familiar with called moon wobble. And moon wobble is an 18.6 year cycle of how the moon is varying on its axis. And it has a direct effect on the ebb and flow of tides for the oceans.
Oh, wow.
And the consequence of it is that if the oceans are rising, which some evidence indicate that the levels of the oceans are rising, that areas that would not normally be concerned about tidal flooding may have to be because of this periodic moon wobble cycle. So, we're dealing with this everywhere. I mean, just this morning on the news, I saw about the floods in Germany. So we seem to be approaching some extremes in so many ways. I'm also always interested to see how many acronyms I can learn as I go through the issue. And the other one I picked up on was the Piston Aviation Fuels Initiative, which must be PAFI.
I think
so. The FAA does a good job of the four and three letter acronyms.
We're not nearly as good as NASA. NASA is much better than we are.
Well, you're giving them a run for their money, I would say. This article, it's a little bit of a primer on some of the terminology related to electrics and certainly electric aircraft. The one thing I picked out of it right away was this comment that electric motors are generally 75 to 95% efficient compared to internal combustion engines. Electric motors are mechanically simpler, they're lighter. However, it's not the ultimate solution because it's all related to battery technology, not only the footprint, the carbon footprint to make batteries, but it's all about the compromise between how long a battery will work and how much it weighs. But this was a great article to kind of, review this whole concept of moving towards electric aircraft. I remember the first electric aircraft I had exposure to was a balsa wood model with a small electric motor on it that would go for maybe 30 seconds.
Oh, wow.
If I was lucky.
I think you probably want most of your flights to go a little longer than that. 30 seconds is longer than the Wright brothers' first flight, but still it wouldn't get you where you need to go. You know, no. James, just he writes a lot of these types of articles for us, and he loves to dig in, and he can take these concepts and really break it down and make it more understandable. So I actually learned quite a bit from watching and reading through this one. Thinking the kilowatt hour is the fuel tank, as it says here, and the counterpart of the gallon And he uses ICE as internal combustion engine. I had to think about that one for a little while. But another point that is made in here, though, he kind of sets it up early on that there are all these advantages to electric motors, so it should be a slam dunk decision, right? Whoops, not so fast. And then brings up the point that you mentioned. But he also mentions the other challenge of the materials, and we've heard this in other contexts too, certainly with some of our electronic gadgets, that cobalt comes from places where both conflict and regulatory structure raise concerns, and that lithium ore mining involves, and I didn't know this until I read it, it involves the kind of environmental impacts associated with open pit and mountaintop removal. So there is nothing that comes without some kind of cost. And the idea is to try to minimize that cost however possible. And it starts with just being aware that there are no simple solutions. The other thing that I learned from this was that, all about the chargers. And there are just a couple of points here, but the complexity of the chargers and how fast you can recharge, that was there's quite a good discussion of that in this piece.
Well, there's the AC chargers, which require an inverter. And then, as I recall in the article, there's talk about DC chargers or fast charging. But that comes at a cost in terms of heat, and it's hard on the battery. So the industry is working through all of the pluses and minuses and trade-offs. But if you think about our first, portable phones that were mostly battery, and they were quite large and heavy, to what we have now, and, it's certainly making progress in the right direction. So,
you reminded me what my first cell phone looked like. It was a brick with a plastic antenna that would kind of extend, and it came in a bag, and there was no way that I was going to pop it in my purse and carry it around for anything. It was my emergency in the car if I'm really desperate phone. Oh, and it was horribly expensive too. So the thing is that, just as you said, one step at a time, things get better and better. And I think one of the points that James really wanted to make in this piece is that because electrification has challenges that are described here, that GA, General Aviation, really has the ability to lead the way and to pioneer and do some path breaking. That's why I think why I call it shocking potential, which is also a play on words. But the potential for this kind of technology to be pioneered in a lot of general aviation aircraft and then move on to the bigger fleets.
Exactly. And I know we're both going to be at the EAA convention in Oshkosh in a short amount of time. That's a place where we often see a lot of innovations, development, trials that ultimately make their way into the marketplace. So,
well, I'm really looking forward to going to see some of it, because I decided to take vacation time this year instead of going in a working capacity. So I'll be there as me, and it means I can do whatever I want and go see whatever I want to see. So that'll be a lot of fun.
It sounds good. This is our vertically speaking column. And of course, I recognize the device in the middle. But it's also interesting that that the discussion is about how weather, temperature, pressure, all of this is affecting the helicopter, of course, and how so much work is being done into electric helicopters. And of course, the one in the middle is a prime example of that.
Yeah, the little guy in the middle, it was so exciting to watch the first flight of a device of any sort on another planet. And I love the fact that Ingenuity has a little piece of a fabric from the Wright Brothers flyer. Yes. Take to it. So that's a really cool thing. But this talks about how the electric helicopter and vertical takeoff and landing stuff, these are really starting to take off, pun intended. that there's already been a world record set for the farthest distance by an electric helicopter. And one of the things that I really took from this piece is I thought of eVTOL. I guess we're still learning how to pronounce our acronyms, but I always thought of that as being more of the short term, get me over the traffic. But it turns out that there are some designs that are looking to fly long distance. 250 nautical miles between charges, that starts to be more significant.
Absolutely. And it shows that this technology is affecting, you know, many segments of aviation. Certainly our fixed wing airplanes, the rotary wing aircraft, certainly has implications in maintenance and new maintenance policies, developments, and procedures. So it's exciting to see this happening. And I wonder a year from now what we'll be reviewing and talking about as we get ready to go to Oshkosh, how much has progressed since then.
Well, I would certainly like to have this kind of transportation available for some of the traffic I used to see anyway. Sure. Not so much anymore.
This is a great article about getting the lead out. And of course, this has been an initiative for many, many years to finally move out of leaded gasoline for avgas. I wasn't sure when it happened in cars, but I saw in the article it was 1996, that was sort of the end of that. This article goes into some detail, of course, about talking about why the amount of lead is necessary in terms of the engine performance, preventing detonation, things like that. But there's a complete initiative on trying to work on an alternative. And I was thinking about when I first started learning to fly at a small airport west of where I live in Madison, the planes at that time parked on basically grass and kind of a combination dirt gravel. There was an asphalt ramp and runway, of course, but where the planes parked was where the dirt was, basically. And it was common practice that we would sample the fuel, pour it on the ground, and carry on. And of course, we're not doing that now. There's mitigations for that. And it's just another example of, you know, the sensitivity to making sure we do it the right way. So.
Well, it is. And we talk about some of the measures, the mitigation measures later on. This piece just sort of summarizes where we are at the Piston Aviation Fuels Initiative. And it involves a lot of different people, the manufacturers, fuel producers, industry associations. And those words there, they look like just words: qualification, authorization, and safe transition. Every single one of those things involves an enormous amount of work and research because, you know, those of us who fly know that there's no way that if you have a fuel issue or something else, you can't just pull over to the side of the road. It's really important for it to work and to work safely and to not damage your engine. So there is a great deal of development and screening and testing, and some organizations have decided to pursue the research separately. And so it's important to note that the FAA is trying to support those who are looking at other approvals too. But the idea is to create something. I think the word, the term I've heard before is the universal drop-in replacement, that you're not going to have to do anything fancy. You just drop in. Instead of using this, you use that.
Well, that term, I just came up with that a few days ago, again, as I was doing a little bit of research. Of course, we're focusing on avgas for the general aviation and some business fleet. But of course, there's another huge movement to produce and create sustainable fuels in the turbine market, certainly the commercial aircraft. And that term came in that one of the key requirements of an appropriate sustainable fuel is that it drop in. In other words, we don't need to redesign the turbine engine. It can just be used, either mixed with or as a substitute. Right. But the article I was reading also cautioned that there has to be some consideration given to the footprint required to make the sustainable fuel can't be bigger than the benefit. So it's always a trade-off. But again, if you think about all of the Jet A and Jet A1 that's consumed on a daily basis. And then not just that, all of the vehicles at the airport. I mean, there's no end to the number of different types of vehicles. I happen to know that some are propane powered, but certainly most of them are diesel powered, or around the local smaller airport, just typical gas, like AFUEL or AutoFuel. But if you think about the impact that could have on this total picture, when you start looking at how much fuel per day is pumped, just at a place like O'Hare, for example, it's
that's a lot.
It's huge, absolutely huge.
It's a pretty substantial and you amount, multiply
that across all the airports in the world, and it begins to be significant. So everything we've talked about with getting the lead out is also applying to the commercial fleet as well.
Cutting through the noise.
It's hard to have an airplane without noise. And I used to, as a child growing up close to an airport, it was a military airport. I used to enjoy the smoke and noise of aircraft. And now we're doing everything we can to mitigate it. And an interesting stat that I read in this article was the number of people exposed to noise is down, but the sensitivity to it is up.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely fascinating. We all know that that's true. Well, we all know that there's a lot of concern about noise, but I think we also know that it's improved a lot. So when I was a kid, and it's still one of my favorite things to reread, I love the book Airport, the original Airport. Mm-hmm. And that was a time when
I remember the scene.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, airplanes were really noisy, and there was this whole subplot about the Meadowood, the community that they flew over, et cetera. And then for so many years when I was working in FAA headquarters down in Washington, D.C., or anywhere in downtown Washington, because National Airport is so close, when you, if you were on the street and an airplane went over, which they did a lot, you had to stop your conversation. You could not talk over it. And that's just not true anymore. But still, sensitivity is up. And so this article talks about how the FAA is trying to do, first of all, to understand why the sensitivity is higher. So there's this neighborhood environmental survey, which is leading to a lot of rethinking about how noise is perceived, how noise is addressed, and what we can do about it. So there's some explanation in the article about the day-night average sound level metric, which, and the explanation of it's there, it's cumulative. And that what the survey did was it gave us a more up-to-date idea of exposure and annoyance. And that's going to contribute to decisions on land use planning and various other things that can be done to mitigate noise and to continue to mitigate. I mean, another line from Airport, the book, was something like, you can't tiptoe an airliner into the air. Well, you can't. But at the same time, we have already made substantial progress in reducing the amount of noise. But there will continue to be reductions, but it's probably going to be a long time before we see silent airplanes, kind of like hybrid cars.
Yeah.
And so there will need to continue to be efforts to reduce the nuisance factor that these have.
Well, and certainly the engine manufacturers and turbine aircraft have made great strides in this. I mean, the high bypass engine is certainly a good alternative compared to, for example, a straight pipe Lear, which was just a straight turbojet without any bypass air. So, a lot of credit goes to the engine manufacturer. I also think that it's important to realize that at places where, an airport may have been first developed in the middle of nowhere and neighborhoods grow up around it, I think you point out in one of your later articles, doesn't really do, any good to huff and puff about that. Right. The key is to try to find ways to work together. And at this same, you know, small airport where I did quite a bit of flying, there was an increasing concern, especially as more people started taking flying lessons and the market was good. There was more feedback from the neighborhoods and more complaints. And what I found was we would engage in some conversations with them, and it really was an education process. I spoke to a gentleman who said, you know, why do you have, you know, when you're coming into land, why do you have to fly over our neighborhood? Why can't you get closer to the runway? And I said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we take an afternoon and I'll take you flying and we'll go up in the airplane. I'll donate the time in the plane and I'll show you kind of what our, you know, parameters are. We can't get so close to the runway on our downwind leg that we can't make a base turn. So we talked a little bit about that, did a little bit of ground school, took them up flying. And although that didn't solve the noise problem, of course, it was a way though to explain it and explain why things are the way they are, that this is not deliberate. You know, we're not out there trying to make noise. And eventually the airport developed a noise abatement program, which of course is another solution to mitigate it. But sometimes you just have to work and educate to kind of understand this. And we can't really talk about noise without also talking about the other part of this, which is hearing protection, you know, in the airplane and walking around airplanes. Again, when I first started, people say that the flight deck is a terrible classroom. It's made more so by the fact that if you don't have headsets on, it's really hard to teach or be taught. So eventually all of our aircraft had intercoms and headsets. And of course, that's the only way to do it. But you know, even the idea of walking around an airplane just for a moment thinking, oh, this isn't going to be too loud. You know, the hearing damage is cumulative, so it pays to, you know, do our job to protect that.
Yeah, I learned that lesson early. I think I took a single lesson with no headset, and I remember coming back and saying to my instructor, so tell me about headsets. And by the time I had my second lesson, I had one.
Yeah, I could probably do it now because I can't hear that well, you know. So the next one is your colleague Tom talked about, you know, sort of practical mitigation of how we can handle noise and, you know, noise sensitive areas. There's a few obvious ones about maybe following a noise abatement procedure, but there's some others.
Well, this piece actually suggests that if there isn't a noise abatement procedure, that you might want to help develop one or to be aware of vertical adjustments. And obviously, if you want to use VX instead of VY, there might be a lower noise signature. But the point is always, the caveat is that safety always comes first. If there's a reason not to do that, then you shouldn't. Reducing power prop speeds, and just doing for helicopters, the Fly Neighborly Noise Abatement Training Program. And there's no reason that some of those can't apply to fixed-wing aircraft as well. So, and Paul, this part in the green over here, a strategy for being a good neighbor involves reaching out to your community. Well, you were doing that before this advice was suggested, just going out on an individual basis and saying, hey, let me talk about why we do what we do. And even though it doesn't make the noise go away, it might create understanding and a better atmosphere for cooperation.
Yeah, I mean, in these cases, nobody's the enemy. It's a matter of how can we best sort things out and work together. The other part of the noise situation too is if you're flying to an unfamiliar airport, get a hold of the chart supplement or what we used to call the airport facility directory and see if there's a noise abatement procedure before you get there. Because you can, you know, if you comply with that, you're already a step ahead.
Well, it's also a piece of that is knowing something about the airport too. Sometimes this may or may not be in the chart supplement, but a lot of airports, including what was my home airport in Virginia, we had a calm wind runway. And there was a runway that we always tried to use when the winds didn't specifically favor the other end, simply because it was better for noise abatement for the houses that had gone up there. And so I think at one point we also changed the pattern. some of the pattern practices to make it more neighborly, more friendly to the community that's grown up around us.
Well, in Madison, where I live, of course, there's a commercial airport, but on the other side of it is a National Guard base. It's an F-16 base at the moment, but they also, it sounds like the F-35s are coming in a couple of years. So of That'll course, the people, it will be fun, except for the people in, I think they've estimated 1,000 houses in the area might have an impact from noise that are the city and associated people are trying to sort that part of it out.
I imagine they are.
Yeah, for sure. This is a fun one on sound judgment for drones, and it's related to just how they're used and some precautions to take.
Yeah, I mean, I love all kinds of aviation, but I have personally been annoyed before in various places where you're sitting out trying to have a peaceful outdoor dinner, picnic, whatever, and suddenly you hear the sound of like a very loud mosquito, me. And you look up and there's a drone flying. And so you may be sympathetic to the pilot, but there are all sorts of concerns, not just about the nuisance factor, but also, are they taking pictures of me? What's going on here? But this piece talks some about the people part, and that's at the end. You know, be courteous, respectful, and responsible, and be mindful of other people's privacy. If you are going to be flying in an area and you can reach out to the people who are going to be there, letting them know in advance, it's kind of like your airport traffic pattern outreach and education. Sure. Yes. Try to reach out and put a human face behind it. But the other piece of this is it really talks a lot about wildlife and the fact that, you know, sometimes you might want to check out a herd of something, particularly if you're on safari, which will be fun to do again someday. But you can't, don't spook the animals. We know that we shouldn't fly more than certain altitudes in fixed wing aircraft. You're not supposed to fly more than 2,000 feet below like a wildlife refuge. And with drones, you also have to keep in mind that you don't want to spook the animals. You don't quite know what they do yet. And there's research on
that. You're right. We don't know what the reaction is. I mean, we need more information. So right now, the common sense approach would be to use common sense.
Well, yeah, back off. And so it was interesting. So this goes to, on the airplane side, there's all sorts of work to mitigate noise, but I was quite interested to see that drone researchers are working with the manufacturers to reduce the buzzing noise and to figure out how to quieten, make them quieter. But the drones for conservation, and there's a link in the Learn More to some of this information, best practices for operating around endangered species as well as sensitive habitats. And think about your launch and recovery sites. And there's an awful lot, as we talked about last month, there's an awful lot that goes into drone flying that it's not a simple, oh, this is easy. I mean, in fact, I think some of it is way more complicated than the kind of flying I'm used to.
I'm sure. Yeah. So, and there's a link in this article about tips and techniques and advice, precautions for flying drones, certainly around people, but also around wildlife. So it would be, it's a good read. I guess I'd never heard SNARJ. I was thinking, was that a six-letter acronym or is that a real word?
It's a real word that I don't know who came up with it, but I did a quote directly from the article. It's the word used for what remains of a bird when it strikes an aircraft. I have seen such material on a couple of airplanes that I have flown before, and I can agree that the word is not pretty, and neither are the results of a bird strike on an airplane, and it's pretty ugly stuff.
Well, and potentially a lot of damage, some serious damage in some cases. On the airline I used to fly for, I would think we had a bird strike a day in our fleet, at least one, maybe more. Part of it is the location of airports. Part of it is just if they're near water, you know, there's an increase. But the part of this is there's a app you can use to report bird strikes, which helps give FAA and other people information about frequency and type of bird and things like that. So it is a real issue. In the plane I, you know, taught in for so long, the manufacturer even had a spec. It wasn't related to bird strikes. It was related to just bugs. You know, in the summer, you're going to hit bugs at lower altitudes. And there was actually a spec for how many bugs per square inch could be on the leading edge of the wing.
Oh my goodness. No. So, well, I really want to encourage people to use this app at the time. I'm pretty sure that a website existed at the time that I had a bird strike, but I didn't know about it. And so I didn't know to report it. Mine was, I was flying with a friend. We were coming back from a night across country, and we were at 4,000 feet approaching a VOR that was getting us closer to our home base. And we heard this thump. And we didn't think bird because it was night, 4,000 feet. We thought we might have lost a cow flap. We started looking, you know, scanning the engine instruments. And when we landed, we both hopped out of the airplane and zipped around the front with flashlights to see what might be missing. And I said, well, I don't see anything. And my friend was a little bit ahead of me. He says, oh, I do. And below the cowl flaps were the remains of the bird that we had hit. And I think it was fairly small, but I remember thinking, what in the heck was this bird doing 4,000 feet at night without position lights? But anyway, it's the thing is, reporting this is part of what gives the FAA information that can be used for mitigation, and airport wildlife managers need information also for the same reason, for mitigation. And that applies not just to birds, but also to deer. I think most people have probably heard my story at some point about years ago, my flying club's airplane was involved in a very ugly deer strike, which took it out of service for about 6 months. We ended up with a better airplane, but oh my goodness, It was not a pretty thing.
No, of course not. No. We're getting into lights, light bulbs. And of course, there's probably none of us in our homes who haven't gone through, you know, replacing incandescent with LEDs. And Jennifer talks about, you know, there's a bit of an education in this. And indeed, there is. Certainly trying to get equivalent wattage is one part of it, but the other is the, you know, the intensity. I think when I first replaced some bulbs in my house with LEDs, it looked like an operating room. It was so bright white. And then I thought there's got to be a better solution. And of course, it's all related to the, you know, the color that comes in. It's 5,000K, which is very bright, 2,700K, which is more warm. But all of this, as it applies to aviation, is a wonderful thing because of the cost benefits, and you can see them forever.
Well, and it's getting used to new things and new terminology when you're talking about the equivalence, because I went through a similar thing with trying to figure out the terms for LEDs when I was switching over, you know, what's the appropriate thing. It's a little bit like the article about trying to understand how electric power equates to internal combustion engines that we're used to. So you have to get used to a few things, but I love that lamp life cost, reliability and maintenance were all factors in there. And there's a lot of expected life of 50,000 versus 2,000, which is pretty darn good. And but one of the things that really is emphasized in this article is that this wasn't a, oh, this is a good idea, let's go do it. There was a lot of research and a lot of study that went into ensuring, like the FAA is supposed to do, that these are safe to use and appropriate.
Compatible with other technologies like the night vision goggles, for example.
Yeah, and I always learn from these articles. One of them was that the FAA requires airports to change all the lights on a single runway so that there can't be any perception differences. looking at what happens in different weather conditions. And then finally, you know, now we're looking at approach lights and approach lighting systems. And by 2024, approach lighting systems across the U.S. and should be LED rather than incandescent. So it's not that far away.
No, it isn't. It's a great application of technology. But like you say, it's not necessarily that this is an immediate solution. There has to be some study and testing. I remember the night that you, I remember on this article, the night you called me to say there's a fire outside my window. So,
oh gosh, yes.
Yeah, this is your article. So,
do you see the flames? So it was Saturday night in June of last year, and I was sitting there with a book and kind of enjoying my Saturday night, and my neighbor texted me. He said, and it just said, "Do you see the flames?" And I went, "What?" And so I tossed, well, I didn't, my book was on my phone, but I had the phone in my hand, and I went dashing out to the door, opened the patio doors, and I looked at the mountains, and they were ablaze. And it turned out I knew that there had been a vehicle fire on the road up that way before, and it was never closer than about 20 miles to me, but 20 miles, when you look out and all you can see is flames, it's not that far away. I know a lot of people who were much more deeply and profoundly and catastrophically affected. But it certainly got my attention, and really, let's just say that I have educated myself in Western wildfire and protocols and that sort of thing. Especially this summer, there are a lot of wildfires, but fortunately we're getting some moisture, and hopefully that will knock them down. But what I was prompted to write about in this particular piece to wrap up the issue, it started out with this quote from Margaret Mead that I've always liked, that the world changes because an individual or a group of concerned and dedicated people get together and do something about it. And I think we all see that there can be a lot of damage that we individually and collectively do. But I use this Pogo quote that we've all heard, "We've met the enemy and he is us." I use that to say we're the problem, but we're also the solution, and we have a role and we can do something. And so let's do what we can.
Well, and that leads into the next one. I'll read the green part because it's good. You probably know the story about everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. Everybody was asked to do an important job. Everybody was sure somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. So somebody got angry because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't. Everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done. In a simple way, saying we all have a role.
Yeah. And so this is a little bit of what can you specifically do? And I think we're all guilty of, and I love the quote, and I use it at the top simply because when there's a big job that everybody tends to see it as all or nothing, well, if I can't fix it, then I can't do anything. And that's not true. So nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And so I just used a couple of tips. You know, the GATS jar years ago, Paul, when I first started learning to fly, I was taught to just throw it on the ramp. And I remember cringing even then because it just seems wrong to do that. And now you could get a fine if you do. And airports have been much better at collection points. And there's the GATS jar and the collection receptacles. And then we've already talked a lot about being quiet and being respectful of the people around. And I wrote in because my home airport, there were empty fields all around it when I first started flying there. Well, that changed. And so that also changed the noise concerns of the neighbors. And so sometimes people at the airport would go, "Oh, we were here first." You know what? It doesn't really matter.
No.
Because if unhappy homeowners go to elected officials, then who was there first doesn't really make a difference. So we all have to do our part to fly friendly.
Exactly. Organic mechanic. This is a fun thing, but It's five steps that are listed, certainly for the maintenance group, about developing a system using the bioengineered cleaners instead of some of the organic chemicals, responsible disposal plans, recycle, certainly talking about, educate your customers. And I think all of this is excellent, but it also applies to an aircraft owner with his own hangar, and how, if he does his own owner maintenance, there's certainly things that the individual aircraft owner can do as well to fit into this model.
I'm trying to do some of them in my own house. I've started using a lot more baking soda, vinegar, and peroxide for cleaning than some of the chemicals that I used to buy. So just every step can count.
Yeah, exactly. So good advice, and it's an example about how this topic really applies to, all aspects in aviation. Sending the drones is certainly more information about the use of drones with some examples. They talk about the red tide in Florida. And I remember that many, many years ago in one of the lakes here, a group hired us to take up a 172 to fly around the shoreline to look at runoff and how far the runoff was. First, where is it coming from, and where, and how far out into the lake it was going? And of course, in today's world, that would be a drone application.
Well, this is an extension, a drone extension of some stuff that the general aviation community has already been involved in. I think there are several, but the one that comes to mind right off is Lighthawk. And one of the things that they do is try to provide not just photography, but often taking decision makers, policy makers, press, anybody up for a flight to show the environmental impacts of certain activities. So this talks about how drones can be used to collect information, but I think that, and that's important, but I've always loved the idea that GA pilots who, because Lighthawk, I believe, is volunteer, that people who get involved in that, it's all about trying to do something to show people who might be in a position to make better decisions, hey, this is what we're really talking about. So drones and general aviation both have helped authorities collect, review, and analyze data.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the time when we move on to some of the people. This is FAA FACES. And this gentleman has an interesting position within the FAA in that he's dealing with environmental issues.
Yeah, Mike Millard, I came across him. He's been in a lot of different roles. He has quite a lot of credentials. I met him in his capacity with maintenance and expertise. And as is always the case, I learn a lot about some of my colleagues in reading this, and they have amazing experience, crew chief on a lot of things, a degree from Embry-Riddle, involved in a lot of new technology, passionate about safety, seminars, FAST team. But it turns out that his current role, which I didn't know, involves overseeing environmental contractors and environmental review determinations. So they do a ton of stuff, aerobatic practice areas, aviation events, UAS, environmental reviews, and the timelines and the bureaucracies. It's a big job, but it's an important one, and it's really great to have somebody who I would say is multilingual. He speaks pilot, he speaks maintenance, he speaks environment, and he speaks aviation and regulation, so it's all good.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of background. These next three individuals are, we're happy to recognize the National GA Award honorees for this year. One individual I know quite well, but it's Ron Timmerman, Flight Instructor of the Year, and Michael Dunkley, the Aviation Technician of the Year, and Adam McGee, who's the FAST Team Representative of the Year. And I work with Adam on another aviation organization, but he has written for us a few times about balloons and lighter than air initiatives.
Yeah, he's been, you've seen several of his articles in the magazine before, his balloon articles. So hopefully, I know there are the ceremonies and some of the events at Oshkosh this year will be a little bit different than usual, but last year the award winners missed their Oshkosh trip entirely. So it's really nice that we're being able to get closer to normal this year.
Yeah, for sure. So congratulations to these people. It's a great honor. So two articles, both related to COVID. This one is certainly about if you've had COVID, tell your AME. The information is certainly that in most cases, you'll be able to receive your medical unless there's some underlying condition that may present a problem. But the spirit of this, which has been the spirit of a lot of the articles by Susan, is we want to find a way to yes.
Yeah, Dr. Northrup is very passionate about that, as you may remember. She's a pilot herself, and her husband is a pilot, so she gets it. And they're working really hard to do a lot of things. But obviously, the last few months, they have been very deeply involved in looking at all the issues surrounding COVID and aviation to make sure that we don't ground people unnecessarily, but that safety is always the top priority.
And the next one, of course, is an extension of that, and that is, you know, the discussion on vaccines. I mean, the bottom line is that for the pilots, if you get a vaccine, you need to wait 48 hours. So that's number one. But that the FAA has approved the ones that we hear about the most. Of course, we hear a lot in the news about the new Delta variant, and there may be one beyond that at some point. We don't really know. However, the main point of this, which I think is essential, is that if we want to stop variants, the best way is to stop the infection rate. And, you know, the path to that is to do common sense things plus vaccines. So.
Yeah, I keep up with it because, you know, like you, I do travel around some. And the fact that the vaccine is almost 100% effective in preventing serious disease and death, it's good news. And it's really, but I think it's important to keep in mind that other preventive measures may be appropriate in certain circumstances. So,
sure. Yeah, we're all learning to manage this and do the best. So we get a little bit close to the end. This is kind of the point where we're kind of talking about some of the news that's in the ATIS column of the magazine. A couple of things are very current. One is the changes to the NOTAM procedures if you're flying into Oshkosh. That's an essential read if you plan on doing that. And then what about the online registry? What's that about, Susan?
So one of the things that we've known for a long time that we needed to do in the FAA was update the registry. There were too many things that were still done on paper, which is the last century, or that required a lot of hand processing. So over the past few years, there's been a massive effort to overhaul the registry. I think they're still trying to look at the October timeframe for launch of it. There'll be a lot of information coming out as it starts to develop. So there won't be any surprises about it. But I think everybody will be very pleased with the much greater ease and efficiency that the new registry will provide. There's an acronym for it, but, you know, we don't need to go through that right now. The FAA has acronyms for everything, as you know.
Is it CARES, or am I thinking of something else?
It is CARES. Very good. And then the shared aircraft operating expenses advisory circular update is another thing that people probably want to take a look at.
Well, and we're all familiar with the ASRS form as part of the NASA program, but now there's an equivalent reporting system for drones, or the UAS system. So that's something new. And then it's so interesting with all the increase in space launches, space activity, space initiatives, that now those areas are being added to our charts so that we can stay abreast of where these places are. I mean, it used to be if it wasn't Vandenberg or Cape Canaveral, those were the only two places. But certainly, That's expanded.
Well, I also feel like I need to put in a plug for the AirVenture NOTAM. If you're going, look at it, because it has changed. There are some major differences this year. So don't, you know before you go is the watchword.
Well, that's almost good advice no matter where you go, right? But especially for EAA this year. So
yes. Because everybody's a little rusty too.
Indeed. We talk about this quite a lot. I see that you print from time to time people's feedback about, you know, the magazine or about articles. There seem to be a variety of options, but is the main one safetybriefing@faa.gov to send a note?
You can do that, but we also monitor the Twitter feed at FAA Safety Brief, email. There's a GA Facebook site, and sometimes we get comments through that. We contribute a lot to the FAA's social media outreach in general. So we do publish sometimes questions that have come up in the social media that aren't directly about the magazine. But the whole idea is that we want to have a dialogue. So always happy to hear from the target audience.
And we talked earlier about getting a copy of this, either download a copy, review it online. If you subscribe to it, you can get it that way. It's a good idea to have a look at this when you're trying to go through the WINGS course. But there are a variety of mechanisms to get this issue, but also the archives. I believe we have a link for that.
Well, we do. We've moved it. Thank you for mentioning that, because it used to be that you had to scroll further down that page. But now if you look at the screenshot, it says downloads, and you can download the PDF version of the magazine for free. But directly below that is a link to the archived issues. And then below that is we have click and read versions of all the major articles. So if you want to just do that. And then we also publish the major articles on the Medium blog that the FAA does. So there are a lot of different ways for the content to get into your hands now. Pick one.
I'm still happy to get the print version, which you send me, which I'm happy to see. But I also download it so that if I happen to be on my iPad or something and I want to review it, I've got it. So it's a great resource. September, October will be our next broadcast, and the date will be determined, and it will, you know, we'll send out the usual notice. I'm looking at a tower, an airport, maybe something that looks like airspace. So what's the next issue?
Well, the tower, of course, I picked. I made that photo on one of my voyages into and out of Phoenix Sky Harbor, because I think I happen to be partial to my hometown tower. Yes, our theme is
you're also partial to your hometown basketball team, but we'll talk about
that. I was going to mention that. Paul and I am in Phoenix, and the Suns are, you know, won the first two games, and our slogan is Rally the Valley.
Our slogan in Milwaukee is Fear the Deer. So,
well, right now it's 2-2. So, yeah. We'll and see. I think you're coming back to Phoenix. So we'll get you.
Okay. So airports, airspace is the next issue.
That's the next airports and airspace. This is not just looking at the rules. It's going to be looking at a lot of different things, a lot of different aspects of working at airports. And you ask about our publication. We're wrapping up on that issue this very week.
Very good. So just another reminder, we've simplified the process to get WINGS AMT credit. There's links to the archive courses that this is talking about. Also some podcasts. So feel free to check out the current issue as well as some of the previous events that we've done.
And I also want to mention this Meet the Team. The safety team and the safety, the magazine team, as well as the FAA safety team, that's a good link too, because the people who are behind all of this care a lot and are passionate about aviation. So always we're part of the community and very happy to be.
So we'll see you at the AA convention in Oshkosh, Susan. It's nice to work with you this evening, and we'll look forward to another broadcast. And for all of our viewers, fly safe.
And we'll be back in September.
Take care.